In this episode, we talk about John Irving. Clarissa tries to convince Greg that World According to Garp is a good book, and Greg disagrees.
You don't think it's a good book?
It is. I don't know. We'll find out. Okay, we're here for episode one of the Books and Beer podcast. I'm Greg.
I'm Clarissa.
And last time we talked sort of about why I sort of tend to veer towards nonfiction, but today we're going to talk about why Clarissa here is more fond of fiction. And as part of that, I read The World According to Garp, and she's previously read it on multiple occasions, so we'll have that to talk about and use that as an example. So, I guess I'll turn it over to Clarissa here to start off with, start explaining why she likes fiction, and then we need it all jump in and we'll start talking about the novel itself. So,
okay. Well, I mean, the question of why I like fiction, it's a little complicated because it's not, I can't really boil it down to any specific thing, and everything I think of when I think of that question comes out sounding a little bit like a cliche, like, well, I like fiction because it transcends the human experience, which is kind of an asshole thing to say, if you'll pardon my French, but I guess what I like about it most is the fact that it's limitless in the sense of when you sit down to write it, you can't impose your own rules. And I guess what really good fiction does for me, which nonfiction can't do, is really bring home an individual experience, the mistakes we make, the relationships we have, the things we love, the ways we hurt each other, those kinds of things, in a unique way. And when it's written really well, it can make you realize that you're not alone, and that in a way that I don't think nonfiction ever has for me. Does that make sense? I mean, I know that that's something that I'm not alone in saying, and it's been said before. But that's how I feel about it. I mean, that's what the best fiction does for me. And there's so many different ways to do it. And one of the things I love in reading is seeing how such incredibly different authors can affect me in the same way. And I think that's really a remarkable artistic thing. I'm probably not being very eloquent, but are you starting to understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I guess we'll sort of to sort of get to the taste, because I think that nonfiction can do a lot of those things as well, but I guess we'll move into talking about John Irving especially and The World According to Garp. So I guess if you're not familiar with The World According to Garp, as I wasn't, I thought that John Irving was sort of airport fiction. I veered away from that, but now I'm, after reading The World According to Garp, I'm sort of, I veered away, and then the novel sort of takes some turns, and I'm sort of veering back towards, sort of, not exactly that characterization, but it's definitely a lot pulpier than I thought it would be.
Well, pulpier how? In the sense that it has some outlandish elements in it, or...?
Yeah. Well, the novel is the story of Garp, which he's conceived by a mother who has no interest in anything beyond regular... in men, beyond as a means for conception. I don't want to spoil too much of it, because some of the elements are pretty outlandish. And if you've read the book, then you don't even... or if you've seen the movie... you haven't even gotten a fraction of the book. We started watching it tonight, and they've changed quite a bit.
The movie's hideous.
It's pretty bad, but we stuck around to watch John Lithgow play a transsexual. And then at that point, we bailed out. But, the mom is not interested in lust or anything like that. Just interested in men for conception, for having a child named Garp after his father.
Well, the best description of Irving that I've ever heard is comparing him to a modern-day Dickens, in the sense that... Oh, don't make that face. He's making a face. In the sense that his novels are sprawling. They have many characters. They have a lot of different plot elements going on at the same time. The narrator's omniscient. at least in Garp it is, in some of his other books it's first person, but that kind of all-knowing omniscient narrator is probably less common today, I'd say, than it was. Well, because you have all these things going on now, these trends with unreliable narrators and limited worldview.
That's just saying that he writes a plain old-style novel. And I don't think that Dickens was concerned about social issues. I mean, there's sort of the Dickens who was actually around, and then like the sort of sort of exaggerated version of Dickens that we have right now, which I think David Simon sort of poked a lot of fun at. In The Wire season 5, which you haven't seen yet, you just got up to season 4, but in season 5 there's a reporter who is sort of charged by his editor to get down to the Dickensian aspect of things, to show the poor undertrodden of the city, and it's sort of treated almost as a like sort of a cartoonish way of dealing with class that is sort of subtly contrasted against what's David Simon does in the show, but also against what Dickens actually did. But I guess I don't really see how he's similar to Dickens. He seems to be more like one of the comparisons on the back of the book was Catch-22, and that sort of it's sort of black comedy, which I didn't find it as comic, but I can sort of see where that's coming from, and that Garp is a pretty weird guy, and he has a lot of weird circumstances. It's sort of a comedy of sort of sexual manners, and
yes, that's a good description of it. And I think Irving too is. It's hard to do humor in literary fiction, and I think Irving succeeds at it more than most authors do. Sometimes it can get a little tedious. You haven't read any of his other books, and there are sometimes when I can read him and I can feel that he's trying too hard, or it seems to me that he's trying too hard to be tongue-in-cheek and to have this sort of slapstick scene set up. But I think, that being said, he does it better than anyone that I can think of coming to mind at the moment.
Well, Pynchon. Like, Pynchon's the sort of the master of slapstick stuff, and I'll say that even though The World According to Garp is probably his best regarded novel, I read through it and I don't know if like my nerves are frayed or whatever because I've seen Batman and Robin in 2012, but like my expectations for comic mischief I guess are pretty high, and a lot of the stuff is just, he sort of puts in and just a lot of stuff that's just silly and it's not quite comic mischief. I mean, there is a really good sequence in the middle of the book. Garp gets married and he has two kids. One of them is away on a sleepover, and so he tells a story to the other one to get him to sleep. And so he tells the story to the kid, and he's sort of writing it. And so Irving gives us this wonderful sort of understanding of the conversation they're having, and Helen, his wife, is charming in from the other room and sort of trying to follow the thread of the conversation and trying to figure out why he's telling this story. And the story sort of, it's a pretty simple story about a dog that's chained to a truck outside and purporting to be Garp's experiences with that dog. And he eventually ends up turning it from a story about teasing to a story about not looking both ways before crossing the street and that kind of stuff. But all throughout it, there's sort of this interplay of trying to figure out, of Helen's trying to read ahead to the story and trying to figure out why he's telling the story. And Garp's trying to sort of construct it in a way in which he can teach some moral to the child. And then afterwards, he sort of fibs once or twice to Helen, sort of explaining how he wrote the story and what the experiences were behind it. But he tells one version of this real story behind it, and then he tells another version of the real story behind it. And I don't think either of them were necessarily true, because it didn't seem to be from the earlier circumstances of the novel that kind of incident would have even had a chance for him to take place. But it's just this really, it's this very interesting little episode in the middle of, and then it goes, of course, more absurd from that, because he runs over to try and retrieve the child from the sleepover and wacky stuff happens.
Mrs. Ralph.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious to know, one of the things that I find most interesting about Irving is the way he deals with sexual issues. And all of his novels have sex and strange sexual relationships and odd sexual quirks and are dealt with one way or another. And prostitution is something that crops up in his novels pretty frequently, or at least the ones that I've read so far. And I guess I'd be curious to know what you made of that, or if you thought it was gimmicky. I know you had you didn't exactly care for the fact that the male characters were, that Garp yeah. strays from his marriage casually, and...
Well, it's like the... I think I stormed in and was like, every single novel that I've read has the guy sort of cheating on his wife. And, I mean, like, really, every single novel depicting people before, like, you know, 1980 or so, I'd say, that I've read. Every non-modern novel. And it's... A lot of the times it is treated in sort of a way where you can, like, go like, okay, I understand why I did it. Like, Stoner has a treatment of affair that I think is absolutely fantastic, and you can really understand, okay, this is why the guy did it. And you sort of have some sympathy for him, even though you recognize that, you know, I probably shouldn't be doing it, but you have some sympathy for it. And then there's classes of novels where it just happens, and it seems almost like it's because the guy's bored or because that's what's expected. Or, as I sort of insinuated, they do it for... The author decides to throw in an affair for conflict, which is, mm-hmm. I think, your suggestion. And
But then what did you make of it when the table was turned and it became Helen's affair?
Well, that still wasn't, like, I just wasn't really convinced by it. Like, it seems like these people are doing really stupid things, and the author hasn't really sold me that this is natural to their characters or anything. I mean, he tried to with Garp, but the only way he sold it, he didn't actually sell it by saying, you know, these are certain endemic character flaws that undid him or whatever, or like tried to get us inside the psychology of Garp. Instead, it was like he did it and then he did it again and then he sort of did it again, and like just creating this pattern of behavior, which is kind of a drawback of the sort of omniscient sort of third part person narrator that you mentioned earlier. But he just didn't really sell it to me, I guess, as something other than a mechanism to drive the plot forward, which was sort of that element becoming more prevalent was what started to turn me against the novel, because I was like, it's turning into like sort of soap opera airport fiction stuff. And although he does use it to push the novel to an interesting place, I think, in terms of having calamity ensue with one of the affairs,
mm-hmm.
The ending of it. And there's this great chapter after it that sort of treats the sort of consequences of the previous chapter almost in an elliptical way. And leaving one of the consequences until the very end, to a point where by the time I was halfway through the chapter, I was checking back and I was like, they haven't really mentioned.
Yeah, this I remember one element. I remember the first time I read that, doing the same thing, because it seemed like there was something that was not being said.
Yeah, I was like, wait,
that you don't want it to be true, but there's.
And it seems almost like he forgot to write that into the novel.
But, and that is one thing, Irving. That's one of the reasons I love John Irving, is he is the master of that. And he is very good at controlling the reader's... I don't know, you could say he's good at controlling the reader's emotion. I don't know that you like to feel controlled by an author, so maybe I won't use that term. But in terms of revealing things like that, he is fantastic. And that is why I would recommend A Widow for 1 Year, because there's I think his best work is in a scene where the main character is a woman named Ruth, and she is also a writer. A lot of Irving's characters are writers. A lot of his work is autobiographical, but I don't think that's a bad thing. And she's learning to drive, and her father is teaching her how to drive, and while he's doing that, he's telling her the story of how her two older brothers died in a car accident, and it's absolutely masterful, and it's really, and then later, what's really great is that he uses that scene to spark another scene when the daughter is grown and she's needing to tell something to her father, and he uses that, like, it's like a mirror of that, and it's, I mean, he's really good at that, and I think the chapter to which you're referring to in Garp is a really good example of how he's good at that, and I think he only got better at it the more he's been writing. Owen Meany, again, A Prayer for Owen Meany, has some moments like that where it's a slow build up to something that you know, you sort of already know is coming, but that you don't want to be true, and it's really one of his strengths, I think, as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that's kind of the pivot point of the book. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, without giving away too much.
I would say, I mean, definitely the nature of it changes a lot after that chapter. It sort mm-hmm. of settles back down. Certain elements, other elements come to the fore. I would say it turns from being sort of a novel about the wacky escapades of Garp and turns into sort of Irving. One of the themes running through the novel is about how people and books and things that have happened, events that have happened, are sort of interpreted by other people and in some ways used by other people to an end that the people themselves may not necessarily be complicit in.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the characters in the novel, Ellen James, when she was 11 or 12, the thing that happens to her is she was raped by two rapists who then cut out her tongue to keep her from telling the police who they were. Of course, the novel's sort of joke to it is that she actually can write, read and write perfectly fine, and so she's still able to give a description to the police and Adam. But as a result of this, an Ellen Jamesians, or the Ellen James Society, Ellen Jamesians, cut out their tongues to protest this horrible act. They do it voluntarily to themselves to protest this horrible act. And they become, well, I mean, that's already pretty extreme, but they become even more militant, I guess, as the book goes on. And that sort of thread comes back to the fore after this sort of apocalyptic event, I would say, in Garp's life, and his sort of own the internal family dynamics sort of drop out of the picture a bit more, and then the other elements of the book come more to the fore, and that was also, I guess, the part that turned me off, because you can tell by reading the book that John Irving doesn't really like feminists.
I would disagree, though. I think John Irving doesn't like extremists.
Well, yeah,
because
but
I think there's definitely an appreciation for the difficulties of what women have to go through and the villainy of men in this book.
Well, I would say that he likes feminism just fine. He just doesn't like feminists.
But I don't know. I don't feel that way. I mean, the characters, some of the craziest characters of the books are feminists, but they're extreme, you know, they're militants. They're people who believe in violence as a means to an end, and that
yeah.
all men are bad. And
but in terms of, like, the way that he treats, pretty much every character that identifies openly as a feminist in the book is treated, or is portrayed in a poor light.
What about Jenny?
She doesn't identify as a feminist.
But she is one, wouldn't you say?
She is, but she doesn't identify as one. She's just like, oh, shucks, I just wanted to tell my life. And she doesn't, I mean, you saw that the book sort of, the movie version sort of gets it a bit wrong, and it sort of makes her seem like she's prescribing her worldview on her son about, you know, not getting into lust and not being interested in, you know, having sex and that kind of thing. But in the book, she's just sort of, yeah, I just don't really care about it. You know, I'd rather play World of Warcraft or, you know,
or read books, as in her case.
And so, you know, it's the same sort of thing. And
well, that's another thing that you took issue with, or at least at the beginning you did. There are a lot of books within this book.
Yes.
And some of them are excerpted.
Yeah.
And I think there are three excerpts within The World According to Garp of Garp's own writing, which I think is a necessary thing.
Yeah.
The book would not feel complete without them, to me.
Yeah.
But I know that when you first started reading the short story of Garp's that is in the beginning, near the beginning of the book, you took issue with it at
yeah.
me. You told me, I'm not sure how I feel about this book within a book. And so I'm wondering what
yeah.
you thought about the second inclusion of the failed essay that he tries to
yeah.
write to get Helen to acknowledge him, and then the chapter from The World According to Bensonhaver, which is Garp's third novel, and which takes place after this calamitous event, which we've alluded to, and I think they're all the second story I could have done without, maybe, but
yeah.
the other two I feel like are crucial to what the novel is.
Well, see, I feel like the first one is definitely important, and I don't think it could have been alluded to throughout the rest of the novel without getting the same effect. And I
no.
think we both, you watch the movie, it's completely changed. Like, after he graduates from high school, in the book, he goes to Vienna with his mother, and they try to write for about a year or so.
He writes his first
yeah.
short story, which is this, the pension grill parts
yeah.
are.
He writes the short story, and she writes her...
She writes her book, her autobiography. And
which,
the what you really can't get a sense of Garp's writing and what Garp's worldview is without, I think, that glimpse. And the movie certainly suffers for it, because
yeah.
they have... instead, in the movie, they go to New York and they make up this cock... He makes up this cockamamie story about magic gloves, and it's the saddest story that Helen has ever read, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
but when you read it within the novel, you get a sense of what kind of writer Garp's going to become, and what it
or what types he at least aspires to at the beginning.
Yes,
and in the book, it's like some guy playing the piano, and then he falls. He's playing a piano from the balcony, and the piano's being hoisted up, and then he falls off the balcony, and then the piano falls down on top of him, and then, oh, you know, it's Looney Tunes shit, and stuff like that. But the novel itself has this weird anecdote with dreams and a bear, which, by the way, if you go on the Wikipedia page for John Irving, they actually have a checklist of all the different elements that are in his books. And some of them is like sex, bears, piano. And they're all sort of checked down. And, you know, several of them are very common in his books. And some of them are less common, but they're still pretty prevalent and that kind of thing. And it seems very combinatorial. But that short story, I feel like, is merited. The third story...
which is the chapter from The World
According to
Bensonhaver.
I feel like the inclusion of that one, it's frustrating because in a way he sort of preempts the criticism that I would make about the novel, is that he includes a lot of lurid stuff in there just to keep the writer's attention, or the reader's attention.
He being Irving, or
Irving,
he being
Irving.
Garp? Okay.
Irving. Right, and... that's sort of his safety valve in the book, because Garp writes a book after this apocalyptic event, and he's not intending it to be a popular work. He's always sort of gone for a more serious work. First time he published a novel, he sort of complains to his publisher about how, you know, it's not popular enough, he's not doing well enough to sell it, and he makes the same sort of complaints after his second novel as well. And then his third novel is published, and it's really a work that it has a lot of personal pain in it. It sort of comes across as very like word stuff, like think The Girl and the Dragon Tattoo level of sort of
violence and
sexual violence and just all sorts of pulpy stuff going on. And it's sort of a reaction of him to this event, but to the general public, it's a nice piece of sort of offensive, trashy fiction that sort of gets a response out of them, and so they like it for that. But that would be the same criticism that I would make out of large chunks of The World According to Garp, is that there's a lot of stuff in there that's just sort of not so much to excite and thrill the reader, but sort of definitely to keep them going on. I would say that a large chunk of the central part of the film, a central part of the book, I wasn't really cared so much about the themes. I just wanted to figure out, you know, how's this all going to play out with Garp and everything.
But so. That's one of the things that I consider the mark of a good writer. Now, some it can be done cheaply, like in, you know, true crime thrillers or whatever, but in literary fiction, to also have a page turner and to have questions about what's going to, you know, how is this going to tie up? And I mean, to me, that's a good thing. That's like, a praiseworthy thing.
But I feel like he didn't accomplish both at the same time. I think at any given time, he was accomplishing one or he was accomplishing the other, but not really both at the same time. And you could feel that throughout the book, I think. Like the opening part of the book, I was sort of enthralled by pretty much as well. But it wasn't so much because it was a page turn, but because it was a generally interesting, you know, young man coming of age, sort of Bildungsroman type thing. And then once Garp becomes an adult, it sort of becomes more pulpy and like having sex with everything that moves, you know, type of thing. And sort of getting into all sorts of hijinks from having had affairs and that kind of thing. And that part was generally more, okay, I want to see how this plays out, but I'm not really getting anything out of it. And then sort of it swings back briefly to the literary side of things in terms of this apocalyptic event that we're constantly alighting. And then towards the end, it sort of doesn't really know where to land, I think. Because there are some events that are pretty sort of doing something to keep the book going. But at the same time, there is some sort of genuine reflection going on. So, I would say that I ended the book with sort of an unease of like, I'm not sure if this was, on the whole, how I would describe this book. And actually, I notched on Goodreads that I'd read it, but I didn't actually review it because I'm not sure at this point. It's probably not a 5, but I don't know if it's a 4 or like a 3 or something like that. I mean, the prose is solid to the end. I'll give him that. He's very excellent on the prose level. But as far as the overall themes of the story, didn't really get me, I guess.
Oh.
Sorry.
I'm sad. I love The World According to Garp.
Yeah, John Irving is one of her favorite
one
authors.
Of my favorites. I don't know if I'd give him the top spot, but he's up there certainly for me. And I've read a lot of his books, and everything I've read by him so far I've liked a lot, which I can't say of every author. His most recent book, I think, Until I Find You, was pretty much universally panned, I think. And I understand why, because it's a novel with a lot of flaws, but I still liked it, and I've read it twice. But I really hope you still will read A Widow for 1 Year, because I think it's better than Garp. I think it's his best work, and every time I read it, it gets better.
I'll tackle it at some point.
And it's very different from Garp as well. It doesn't deal with the same things. I mean, it does have some sex and some affairs and some womanizing, but it's not. It's an entirely different book, and it's really special.
See, I would say a different book that I think that would characterize the type of book that I would have preferred The World According to Garp to be is The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which is also set in Vienna, I think. Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Also, those two writers are so different. I feel like that's kind of comparing apples to oranges.
But it's. I mean, there's a lot of sex and affairs going on, and there's sort of a lot of dealing with the act of writing and sort of what that means. But Milan Kundera, I think I'm probably butchering the name.
thought it was Kundera.
Kundera.
We don't know anything.
I went to Kansas State University. I've read these books, and I've never actually talked about them to very many other people. Whereas she went to fancy Boston University, BU.
Oh, please.
And got to hang out with the literati before they started taking down Newt Gingrich, of course. Literati and their minions.
Did you finish your beer?
Yeah, of course I did.
Okay.
Which, by the way, we haven't mentioned. I'm drinking Chai Town, Windy City Wheat, Belgian White Ale.
I have Anchor Steam's Humming Ale, which is the first time I've tried it, but I like Anchor Steam a lot, and it has not disappointed me tonight.
Cool. And this has been beer for me. So I don't have any palate when it comes to beer, unfortunately. But I don't really have a sense of taste in general, so.
So what are you going to read next now that you read The World According to Garp in 24 hours?
Less than that. I read it in 10.
Which, I'm going to put a point in Irving's box for that, because you're not a fast reader. I mean, you can be when you want to be. And I think you wanted to be for this, and even if you don't want to admit it,
But 10 hours is 10 hours. I mean, I didn't do much else in those 10 hours.
Exactly. That's a substantial. Well,
because I didn't have. I mean, it's Sunday.
I mean, that's a substantial novel. That's...
I mean, what was I going to watch, the Pro Bowl? I read that pretty fast. But one of the reasons that I did read it pretty fast was to read it, to talk about it here, because
since we were going to talk about how Corissa likes fiction more. I figured I'd read one of her favorite authors and get an insight into what makes her tick. But the third reason is that this morning, on Sunday morning, for some reason, an Amazon.com delivery came in, and the third book in Caro's biography of Lyndon Baines Johnson, called Master of the Senate, showed up. It's about 1,200 pages. It could probably kill a man if it fell down from the bookshelf. And I'm going to read it here pretty fast, I think, because I tore through Means of Ascent pretty quickly once I got started. And I'm really into reading now, so which cannot always have been said, because, you know, like during the football season, it's like you got 5 days of work and then you got Saturday pretty much for doing, you know, whatever else you have to get down the weekend, and then Sunday is football for us.
No more.
And so,
after next week.
Yeah, I've got a whole extra day, and that adds a lot to my free time. So I'm reading a lot more, and it's still cold outside here in Chicago. So starting Master of the Senate, won the Pulitzer. I've heard people call it the best political biography they've ever read.
You can tell how excited Greg
is.
Greg is really excited about this.
It's been really hard to keep myself from... opening it while I was finishing A World According to Garp, so that'll be real exciting. And I finished some other books too recently. I finished Means of Ascent, the second volume of Caro, and also Inside Apple, which is the book that you should read instead of the Steve Jobs biography if you haven't read either. What have you been reading lately?
I just finished The Road today, which I'm several years behind everybody else in the world in reading that book, but,
yeah, she's read Sutri by Cormac McCarthy, but she hasn't read The Road.
I put it off for a while because it was popular, and because, I think the biggest reason was I knew it was going to be depressing, and I didn't want to go there, and
oh my God.
Sure enough, I finished it today, and I cried a little, but I knew I had to do it, and so I did it, and... Now, I'm probably going to read this collection of essays that Greg ordered, Pulpit by John Jeremiah Sullivan, which was a finalist. It's a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award.
Yeah, they haven't handed out the award yet, so it may yet win it.
But it looks very interesting, and I always appreciate a well-written essay. And then I'm not sure what I'm going to tackle after that. There are many options here in our apartment full of books.
We have a lot of books. So... And we'll try and figure out for next time which next book we're going to share in reading and talk about. And at some point we have some other topics we'd like to tackle down the road, like young adult fiction.
Yes.
Which I think you've read more of than I have.
Yes,
because you read that, you tore through like the Hunger Games or something.
I did. I read those over Christmas, and I'm glad I did. That was enjoyable.
So I need to read some young adult books myself, so we can talk about them.
Maybe you can read the Hunger Games. They're on my Kindle.
I could. Yeah, I mean they're pretty fast read, or but then like you gotta read other stuff that's like more critically acclaimed, so you can like come to a reasoned conclusion about the genre itself. Because there's a lot of, I would say that at this point. Not to spoil anything, but there's a lot of concerns that I have about problems that are endemic to the YA genre, just as there are to, like, most other genres have their own little weird quirks and blind spots and stuff. But at the moment, they're only suspicions, so I'm hoping to make them confirm them. Sometimes I read bad books just to confirm that they're bad, just like I'll watch bad movies just to confirm they're bad. Like, Green Lantern, that's a bad movie. It's a really bad movie.
Okay, we're not talking about books or beer anymore, so...
Well, that's fine. We talk about all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
So, you can find episodes at booksandbeer.net. We'll have another one here in about a week or two. So, stay tuned. And if you have any questions, just let us know on our respective blogs, because that's probably where you found it. Or, you know, whatever. I mean, you know.
Or suggestions.
Or suggestions about more stuff that we should read.
Thoughts about John Irving.
Yeah. Angry emails. We accept those as well. That kind of thing. So, yeah. And we'll be back in a week, like I just said. So, see, the downside of having anything books and beer is that if it's late at night and I haven't had anything to eat in a while,
yeah,
then
you can tell.
I sort of
you
fall
can tell
apart
by the end of
the
podcast that he's finished his beer.
So, yeah. See y'all later.
Thanks.